There was no hope left. By the middle of the second week, everyone in the squadron began to look like Hungry Joe, who was not scheduled to fly, and screamed horribly in his sleep. He was the only one who could sleep. All night long, men moved through the darkness outside their tents like tongueless wraiths with cigarettes. In the daytime, they stared at the bomb line in futile, drooping clusters, or at the still figure of Doc Danica sitting in front of the closed door of the medical tent beneath the morbid, hand-lettered sign. They began to invent humorless, glum jokes of their own and disastrous rumors about the destruction awaiting them at Bologna. Yossarian sidled up drunkenly to Colonel Korn at the officers' club one night to kid with him about the new LePage gun that the Germans had moved in.
"What LePage gun?" Colonel Korn inquired with curiosity.
"The new 344-millimeter LePage glue gun," Yossarian answered. "It glues a whole formation of planes together in midair." Colonel Korn jerked his elbow free from Yossarian's clutching fingers in startled affront.
"Let go of me, you idiot!"
he cried out furiously, glaring with vindictive approval as Nately leaped upon Yossarian's back and pulled him away.
"Who is that lunatic, anyway?"
Colonel Cathcart chortled merrily.
"That's the man you made me give a medal to after Ferrara. You had me promote him to captain, too, remember? Serves you right."
Nately was lighter than Yossarian and had great difficulty maneuvering Yossarian's lurching bulk across the room to an unoccupied table.
"Are you crazy?" Nately kept hissing with trepidation. "That was Colonel Korn. Are you crazy?"
Yossarian wanted another drink and promised to leave quietly if Nately brought him one. Then he made Nately bring him two more. When Nately finally coaxed him to the door, Captain Black came stomping in from the outside, banging his sloshing shoes down hard on the wood floor and spilling water from his eaves like a high roof.
"Boy, are you bastards in for it," he announced exuberantly, splashing away from the puddle forming at his feet. "I just got a call from Colonel Korn. Do you know what they've got waiting for you at Bologna? Ha! They got the new LePage glue gun. It glues a whole formation of planes together right in midair."
"My God, it's true!"
Yossarian shrieked and collapsed against Nately in terror.
"There is no God," answered Dunbar calmly, coming up with a slight stagger.
"Hey, give me a hand with him, will you? I've got to get him back in his tent."
"Says who?"
"Says me.
Gee, look at the rain. We got to get a car."
"Steal Captain Black's car," said Yossarian. "That's what I always do."
"We can't steal anybody's car. Since you began stealing the nearest car every time you wanted one, nobody leaves the ignition on."
"Hop in," said Chief White Half-Hoat, driving up drunk in a covered jeep.
He waited until they had crowded inside and then spurred ahead with a suddenness that rolled them all over backward. He roared with laughter at their curses. He drove straight ahead when he left the parking lot and rammed the car into the embankment on the other side of the road. The others piled forward in a helpless heap and began cursing him again.
"I forgot to turn," he explained.
"Be careful, will you?" Nately cautioned. "You'd better put your headlights on."
Chief White Half-Oat pulled back in reverse, made his turn, and shot away up the road at top speed. The wheels were sibilant on the whizzing blacktop surface.
"Not so fast," urged Nately.
"You better take me to your squadron first so I can help you put him to bed. Then you can drive me back to my squadron."
"Who the hell are you?"
"Dunbar." "Hey, put your headlights on," Nately shouted, "and watch the road."
"They are on. Isn't Yossarian in this car? That's the only reason I let the rest of you bastards in."
Chief White Half-Oat turned completely around to stare into the back seat.
"Watch the road!"
"Yossarian? Is Yossarian in here?"
"I'm here, Chief. Let's go home." "What makes you so sure? You never answered my question."
"You see, I told you he was here."
"What question?" "Whatever it was we were talking about."
"Was it important?"
"I don't remember if it was important or not. I wish to God I knew what it was."
there is no God.
That's what we were talking about, Yusarian cried. What makes you so sure?
Hey, are you sure your headlights are on?
Nately called out.
They're on. They're on. What does he want from me? It's all this rain on the windshield that makes it look dark from back there.
Beautiful, beautiful rain.
I hope it never stops raining. Rain, rain, go away, come again some other day. Little Yo-Yo wants to play in the meadow in.
Chief White Half-Oat missed the next turn in the road and ran the jeep all the way up to the crest of a steep embankment. Rolling back down, the jeep turned over on its side and settled softly in the mud. There was a frightened silence.
Is everyone all right?
Chief White Half-Oat inquired in a hushed voice. No one was injured, and he heaved a long sigh of relief.
You know, that's my trouble, he groaned. I never listened to anybody. Somebody kept telling me to put my headlights on, but I just wouldn't listen.
I kept telling you to put your headlights on.
I know, and I just wouldn't listen, would I? I wish I had a drink. I do have a drink. Look, it's not broken.
It's raining in, Nately noticed. I'm getting wet.
Chief White Half-Oat got the bottle of rye open, drank, and handed it off. Lying tangled up on top of each other, they all drank, but Nately, who kept groping ineffectually for the door handle. The bottle fell against his head with a clunk, and whiskey poured down his neck. He began writhing convulsively.
Hey, we gotta get out of here, he cried. We'll all drown. Is anybody in there?
Asked Clevenger with concern, shining a flashlight down from the top.
It's Clevenger!
They shouted and tried to pull him in through the window as he reached down to aid them.
Look at them!
Clevenger exclaimed indignantly to McWatt, who sat grinning at the wheel of the staff car.
Lying there like a bunch of drunken animals. You too, Nately? You ought to be ashamed. Come on, help me get them out of there before they all die of pneumonia.
You know, that don't sound like such a bad idea, Chief White Half-Oat reflected. I think I will die of pneumonia.
Why?
Why not? Answered Chief White Half-Oat, and lay back in the mud contentedly with a bottle of rye cuddled in his arms.
Oh, now look what he's doing,
Clevenger exclaimed with irritation.
Will you get up and get into the car so we can all go back to the squadron? We can't all go back. Someone has to stay here and help the chief with his car he signed out of the motor pool.
Chief White Half-Oat settled back in the staff car with an ebullient, prideful chuckle.
That's Captain Black's car, he informed them jubilantly.
I stole it from him at the officers' club just now with an extra set of keys he thought he lost this morning.
Well, I'll be damned. That calls for a drink.
Haven't you had enough to drink?
Clevenger began scolding as soon as McWatt started the car.
Look at you. You don't care if you drink yourselves to death or drown yourselves to death, do you?
Just as long as we don't fly ourselves to death.
Hey, open it up. Open it up.
Chief White Half-Oat urged McWatt.
And turn off the headlights. That's the only way to do it.
Dr. Neek is right, Clevenger went on. People don't know enough to take care of themselves. I really am disgusted with all of you.
Okay, fat mouth. Out of the car, Chief White Half-Oat ordered. Everybody get out of the car but Yusarian. Where's Yusarian?
Get the hell off me!
Yusarian laughed, pushing him away.
You're covered with mud.
Clevenger focused on Nately.
You're the one who really surprises me. Do you know what you smell like? Instead of trying to keep him out of trouble, you get just as drunk as he is. Suppose he got in another fight with Appleby.
Clevenger's eyes opened wide with alarm when he heard Yusarian chuckle.
He didn't get in another fight with Appleby, did he?
Not this time,
said Dunbar.
No, not this time. This time, I did even better.
This time he got in a fight with Colonel Korn. He didn't,
gasped Clevenger.
He did?
Exclaimed Chief White Half-Oat with delight.
That calls for a drink.
But that's terrible,
Clevenger declared with deep apprehension.
Why in the world did you have to pick on Colonel Korn? Say, what happened to the lights? Why is everything so dark?
I turned them off, answered McWatt.
You know, Chief White Hatboat is right. It's much better with the headlights off.
Are you crazy?
Clevenger screamed and lunged forward to snap the headlights on. He whirled around upon Yossarian in near hysteria.
You see what you're doing? You've got them all acting like you. Suppose it stops raining and we have to fly to Bologna tomorrow. You'll be in fine physical condition.
It won't ever gonna stop raining. No, sir, a rain like this really might go on forever.
It has stopped raining, someone said, and the whole car fell silent.
You poor bastards, Chief White Half-Oat murmured compassionately after a few moments had passed.
Did it really stop raining?
Yossarian asked meekly. McWatt switched off the windshield wipers to make certain. The rain had stopped. The sky was starting to clear. The moon was sharp behind a gauzy brown mist.
Oh, well,
sang McWatt soberly.
What the hell?
Don't worry, fellas, Chief White Half-Oat said. The landing strip is too soft to use tomorrow. Maybe it'll start raining again before the fuel dries out.
You goddamn stinking lousy son of a bitch!
Hungry Joe screamed from his tent as they sped into the squadron.
Jesus, is he back here tonight? I thought he was still in Rome with a courier ship. Oh!
Hungry Joe screamed. Chief White Half-Oat shuddered.
That guy gives me the willies, he confessed in a grouchy whisper. Hey, whatever happened to Captain Flume?
There's a guy that gives me the willies. I saw him in the woods last week eating wild berries. He never sleeps in his trailer anymore. He looked like hell.
Hungry Joe's afraid he'll have to replace somebody who goes on sick call, even though there is no sick call. Did you see him the other night when he tried to kill Havermeyer and fell into Yossarian's slit trench?
Oh,
screamed Hungry Joe.
Oh!
Sure is a pleasure not having Flume around in the mess hall anymore. No more of that pass the salt, Walt.
Or pass the bread, Fred.
Or shoot me a beet, Pete.
Keep away! Keep away! Hungry Joe screamed. I said keep away! Keep away, you goddamn stinking lousy son of a bitch!
Well, at least we found out what he dreams about, Dunbar observed wryly. He dreams about goddamn stinking lousy sons of bitches.
Late that night, Hungry Joe dreamed that Hoople's cat was sleeping on his face, suffocating him. And when he woke up, Hoople's cat was sleeping on his face. His agony was terrifying. The piercing, unearthly howl with which he split the moonlit dark, vibrating in its own impact for seconds afterward like a devastating shock. A numbing silence followed, and then a riotous din rose from inside his tent. Yossarian was among the first ones there. When he burst through the entrance, Hungry Joe had his gun out and was struggling to wrench his arm free from Hoople to shoot the cat, who kept spitting and feinting at him ferociously to distract him from shooting Hoople. Both humans were in their GI underwear. The unfrosted light bulb overhead was swinging crazily on its loose wire, and the jumbled black shadows kept swirling and bobbing chaotically, so that the entire tent seemed to be reeling. Yossarian reached out instinctively for balance, and then launched himself forward in a prodigious dive that crushed the three combatants to the ground beneath him. He emerged from the melee with the scruff of a neck in each hand, Hungry Joe's neck and the cat's. Hungry Joe and the cat glared at each other savagely. The cat spat viciously at Hungry Joe, and Hungry Joe tried to hit it with a haymaker.
A fair fight,
Yossarian decreed, and all the others who had come running to the uproar in horror began cheering ecstatically in a tremendous overflow of relief.
We'll have a fair fight, he explained officially to Hungry Joe and the cat after he had carried them both outside,
still holding them apart by the scruffs of their necks.
Fists, fangs, and claws. But no guns,
he warned Hungry Joe.
And no spitting,
he warned the cat sternly.
When I turn you both loose, go. Break clean in the clinches and come back fighting. Go.
There was a huge, giddy crowd of men who were avid for any diversion. But the cat turned chicken the moment Yossarian released him and fled from Hungry Joe ignominiously like a yellow dog. Hungry Joe was declared the winner. He swaggered away happily with the proud smile of a champion, his shriveled head high and his emaciated chest out. He went back to bed victorious and dreamed again that Hoople's cat was sleeping on his face, suffocating him. 13. Major Hm-Hm de Coverley. Moving the bomb line did not fool the Germans, but it did fool Major Ha-Ha de Coverley, who packed his musette bag, commandeered an airplane, and, under the impression that Florence, too, had been captured by the Allies, had himself flown to that city to rent two apartments for the officers and the enlisted men in the squadron to use on rest leaves. He had still not returned by the time Yossarian jumped back outside Major Major's office and wondered whom to appeal to next for help. Major Hm-Hm de Coverley was a splendid, awe-inspiring, grave old man, with a massive leonine head and an angry shock of wild white hair that raged like a blizzard around his stern, patriarchal face. His duties as squadron executive officer did consist entirely, as both Dr. Nika and Major Major had conjectured, of pitching horseshoes, kidnapping Italian laborers, and renting apartments for the enlisted men and officers to use on rest leaves. And he excelled at all three. Each time the fall of a city like Naples, Rome, or Florence seemed imminent, Major Aha de Coverley would pack his musette bag, commandeer an airplane and a pilot, and have himself flown away, accomplishing all this without uttering a word, by the sheer force of his solemn, domineering visage and the peremptory gestures of his wrinkled finger. A day or two after the city fell, he would be back with leases on two large and luxurious apartments there, one for the officers and one for the enlisted men, both already staffed with competent, jolly cooks and maids. A few days after that, newspapers would appear throughout the world with photographs of the first American soldiers bludgeoning their way into the shattered city through rubble and smoke. Inevitably, Major Hm-Hm de Coverley was among them, seated straight as a ramrod in a jeep he had obtained from somewhere, glancing neither right nor left as the artillery fire burst about his invincible head, and lithe young infantrymen with carbines went loping up along the sidewalks in the shelter of burning buildings or fell dead in doorways. He seemed eternally indestructible as he sat there surrounded by danger, his features molded firmly into that same fierce, regal, just, and forbidding countenance which was recognized and revered by every man in the squadron. To German intelligence, Major Hm-Hm de Coverley was a vexatious enigma. Not one of the hundreds of American prisoners would ever supply any concrete information about the elderly white-haired officer with a gnarled and menacing brow and blazing, powerful eyes, who seemed to spearhead every important advance so fearlessly and successfully. To American authorities, his identity was equally perplexing. A whole regiment of crack CID men had been thrown into the front lines to find out who he was, while a battalion of combat-hardened public relations officers stood on red alert 24 hours a day with orders to begin publicizing him the moment he was located. In Rome, Major Hm-Hm de Coverley had outdone himself with the apartments. For the officers, who arrived in groups of four or five, there was an immense double room for each in a new white stone building, with three spacious bathrooms with walls of shimmering aquamarine tile and one skinny maid named Michela, who tittered at everything and kept the apartment in spotless order. On the landing below lived the obsequious owners. On the landing above lived the beautiful, rich, black-haired countess and her beautiful, rich, black-haired daughter-in-law, both of whom would put out only for Natalie, who was too shy to want them, and for Arfie, who was too stuffy to take them and tried to dissuade them from ever putting out for anyone but their husbands, who had chosen to remain in the North with the family's business interests.
"They're really a couple of good kids," Arfie confided earnestly to Yossarian,
whose recurring dream it was to have the nude, milk-white female bodies of both these beautiful, rich, black-haired good kids lying stretched out in bed erotically with him at the same time. The enlisted men descended upon Rome in gangs of 12 or more, with gargantuan appetites and heavy crates filled with canned food for the women to cook and serve to them in the dining room of their own apartments on the 6th floor of a red brick building with a clinking elevator. There was always more activity at the enlisted men's place. There were always more enlisted men to begin with, and more women to cook and serve and sweep and scrub. And then there were always the gay and silly, sensual young girls that Yossarian had found and brought there, and those that the sleepy enlisted men returning to Pianosa after their exhausting 7-day debauch had brought there on their own and were leaving behind for whoever wanted them next. The girls had shelter and food for as long as they wanted to stay. All they had to do in return was hump any of the men who asked them to, but seemed to make everything just about perfect for them. Every fourth day or so, Hungry Joe came crashing in like a man in torment, hoarse, wild, and frenetic, if he had been unlucky enough to finish his missions again and was flying the courier ship. Most times he slept at the enlisted men's apartment. Nobody was certain how many rooms Major Ha-Ha de Coverley had rented, not even the stout, black-bodiced woman in corsets on the first floor from whom he had rented them. They covered the whole top floor, and Yossarian knew they extended down to the 5th floor as well, for it was in Snowden's room on the 5th floor that he had finally found the maid in the lime-colored panties with a dust mop the day after Bologna, after Hungry Joe had discovered him in bed with Luciana at the officer's apartment that same morning and had gone running like a fiend for his camera. The maid in the lime-colored panties was a cheerful, fat, obliging woman in her mid-30s, with squashy thighs and swaying hams in lime-colored panties that she was always rolling off for any man who wanted her. She had a plain, broad face and was the most virtuous woman alive. She laid for everybody, regardless of race, creed, color, or place of national origin, donating herself sociably as an act of hospitality, procrastinating not even for the moment it might take to discard the cloth or broom or dust mop she was clutching at the time she was grabbed. Her allure stemmed from her accessibility. Like Mount Everest, she was there, and the men climbed on top of her each time they felt the urge. Yossarian was in love with the maid in the lime-colored panties, because she seemed to be the only woman left he could make love to without falling in love with. Even the bald-headed girl in Sicily still evoked in him strong sensations of pity, tenderness, and regret. Despite the multiple perils to which Major Ha-Han de Coverley exposed himself each time he rented apartments, his only injury had occurred, ironically enough, while he was leading the triumphal procession into the open city of Rome, where he was wounded in the eye by a flower fired at him from close range by a seedy, cackling, intoxicated old man who, like Satan himself, had then bounded up on Major Ha-Ha de Coverley's car with malicious glee, seized him roughly and contemptuously by his venerable white head, and kissed him mockingly on each cheek, with a mouth reeking with sour fumes of wine, cheese, and garlic, before dropping back into the joyous, celebrating throngs with a hollow, dry, excoriating laugh. Major Ha-Ha de Coverley, a Spartan in adversity, did not flinch once throughout the whole hideous ordeal, and not until he had returned to Pianosa, his business in Rome completed, did he seek medical attention for his wound. He resolved to remain binocular, and specified to Dr. Nika that his eye patch be transparent, so that he could continue pitching horseshoes, kidnapping Italian laborers, and renting apartments with unimpaired vision. To the men in the squadron, Major de Coverley was a colossus, although they never dared tell him so. The only one who ever did dare address him was Milo Minderbinder, who approached the horseshoe pitching pit with a hard-boiled egg his second week in the squadron and held it aloft for Major de Coverley to see. Major de Coverley straightened with astonishment at Milo's effrontery and concentrated upon him the full fury of his storming countenance, with its rugged overhang of gullied forehead and huge crag of a humpbacked nose that came charging out of his face wrathfully like a Big Ten fullback. Milo stood his ground, taking shelter behind the hard-boiled egg raised protectively before his face like a magic charm. In time, the gale began to subside, and the danger passed.
"What is that?" Major de Coverley demanded at last.
"An egg," Milo answered.
"What kind of an egg?" Major de Coverley demanded.
"A hard-boiled egg," Milo answered.
"What kind of a hard-boiled egg?" Major de Coverley demanded.
"A fresh, hard-boiled egg," Milo answered.
"Where did the fresh egg come from?"
Major de Coverley demanded.
"From a chicken,"
Milo answered.
"Where is the chicken?"
Major de Coverley demanded.
"The chicken is in Malta,"
Milo answered.
"How many chickens are there in Malta?"
"Enough chickens to lay fresh eggs for every officer in the squadron at 5 cents apiece from the mess fund,"
Milo answered.
"I have a weakness for fresh eggs," Major de Coverley confessed.
"If someone put a plane at my disposal, I could fly down there once a week in a squadron plane and bring back all the fresh eggs we need," Milo answered. "After all, Malta's not so far away."
"Malta's not so far away,"
Major de Coverley observed.
"You could probably fly down there once a week in a squadron plane and bring back all the fresh eggs we need."
"Yes,"
Milo agreed.
"I suppose I could do that, if someone wanted me to, and put a plane at my disposal."
"I like my fresh eggs fried,"
Major de Coverley remembered.
"In fresh butter."
"I can find all the fresh butter we need in Sicily for 25 cents a pound,"
Milo answered.
25 cents a pound for fresh butter is a good buy. There's enough money in the mess fund for butter, too, and we could probably sell some to the other squadrons at a profit and get back most of what we pay for our own."
"What's your name, son?" asked Major de Coverley.
"My name is Milo Minderbinder, sir. I'm 27 years old."
"You're a good mess officer, Milo."
"I'm not the mess officer, sir."
"You're a good mess officer, Milo."
"Thank you, sir. I'll do everything in my power to be a good mess officer."
"Bless you, my boy. Have a horseshoe."
"Thank you, sir. What should I do with it?"
"Throw it."
"Away?"
"At that peg there. Then pick it up and throw it at this peg. It's a game, see? You get the horseshoe back."
"Yes, sir. I see. How much are horseshoes selling for?"
The smell of a fresh egg snapping exotically in a pool of fresh butter carried a long way on the Mediterranean trade winds and brought General Dreidel racing back with a voracious appetite, accompanied by his nurse, who accompanied him everywhere, and his son-in-law, Colonel Mudus. In the beginning, General Dreidel devoured all his meals in Milo's mess hall. Then the other three squadrons in Colonel Cathcart's group turned their mess halls over to Milo and gave him an airplane and a pilot each, so that he could buy fresh eggs and fresh butter for them, too. Milo's plane shuttled back and forth 7 days a week as every officer in the four squadrons began devouring fresh eggs in an insatiable orgy of fresh egg eating. General Dreidel devoured fresh eggs for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Between meals, he devoured more fresh eggs. until Milo located abundant sources of fresh veal, beef, duck, baby lamb chops, mushroom caps, broccoli, South African rock lobster tails, shrimp, hams, puddings, grapes, ice cream, strawberries, and artichokes. There were three other bomb groups in General Dreidel's combat wing, and they each jealously dispatched their own planes to Malta for fresh eggs, but discovered that fresh eggs were selling there for 7 cents apiece. Since they could buy them for Milo for 5 cents apiece, it made more sense to turn over their mess halls to his syndicate, too, and give him the planes and pilots needed to ferry in all the other good food he promised to supply as well. Everyone was elated with this turn of events, most of all Colonel Cathcart, who was convinced he had won a feather in his cap. He greeted Milo jovially each time they met, and, in an excess of contrite generosity, impulsively recommended Major Major for promotion. The recommendation was rejected at once at 27th Air Force Headquarters by XPFC Wintergreen, who scribbled a brusque, unsigned reminder that the Army had only one Major 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 Major, and did not intend to lose him by promotion just to please Colonel Cathcart. Colonel Cathcart was stung by the blunt rebuke and skulked guiltily about his room in smarting repudiation. He blamed Major Major for this black eye and decided to bust him down to lieutenant that very same day. "They probably won't let you," Colonel Korn remarked with a condescending smile, savoring the situation, "for precisely the same reasons they wouldn't let you promote him. Besides, you'd certainly look foolish trying to bust him down to lieutenant right after you tried to promote him to my rank." Colonel Cathcart felt hemmed in on every side. He had been much more successful in obtaining a medal for Yossarian after the debacle of Ferrara, when the bridge spanning the Po was still standing undamaged 7 days after Colonel Cathcart had volunteered to destroy it. 9 missions his men had flown there in 6 days, and the bridge was not demolished until the 10th mission on the 7th day, when Yossarian killed Kraft and his crew by taking his flight of 6 planes in over the target a second time. Yossarian came in carefully on his second bomb run, because he was brave then. He buried his head in his bomb sight until his bombs were away. When he looked up, everything inside the ship was suffused in a weird orange glow. At first he thought his own plane was on fire. Then he spied the plane with the burning engine directly above him and screamed to McWatt through the intercom to turn hard left. A second later, the wing of Kraft's plane blew off. The flaming wreck dropped, first the fuselage, then the spinning wing, while a shower of tiny metal fragments began tap-dancing on the roof of Yossarian's own plane, and the incessant ka-chung, ka-chung, ka-chung of the flak was still thumping all around him. Back on the ground, every eye watched grimly as he walked in dull dejection up to Captain Black outside the green, clabbered briefing room to make his intelligence report, and learned that Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn were waiting to speak to him inside. Major Danby stood barring the door, waving everyone else away in ashen silence. Yossarian was leaden with fatigue and longed to remove his sticky clothing. He stepped into the briefing room with mixed emotions, uncertain how he was supposed to feel about Kraft and the others, for they had all died in the distance of a mute and secluded agony, at a moment when he was up to his own ass in the same vile, excruciating dilemma of duty and damnation. Colonel Cathcart, on the other hand, was all broken up by the event. "Twice?" he asked. "I would have missed it the first time," Yossarian replied softly, his face lowered. Their voices echoed slightly in the long, narrow bungalow. "But twice?" Colonel Cathcart repeated in vivid disbelief. "I would have missed it the first time," Yossarian repeated. "But Kraft would be alive, and the bridge would still be up. A trained bombardier is supposed to drop his bombs the first time," Colonel Cathcart reminded him. "The other 5 bombardiers dropped their bombs the first time.
And missed the target, Yusurian said. We'd have had to go back there again.
And maybe you would have gotten it the first time then.
And maybe I wouldn't have gotten it at all.
But maybe there wouldn't have been any losses.
And maybe there would have been more losses, with the bridge still left standing. I thought you wanted the bridge destroyed.
Don't contradict me, Colonel Cathcart said. We're all in enough trouble.
I'm not contradicting you, sir.
Yes, you are. Even that's a contradiction.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Colonel Cathcart cracked his knuckles violently. Colonel Korn, a stocky, dark, flaccid man with a shapeless paunch, sat completely relaxed on one of the benches in the front row, his hands clasped comfortably over the top of his bald and swarthy head. His eyes were amused behind his glinting, rimless spectacles.
"We're trying to be perfectly objective about this," he prompted Colonel Cathcart.
"We're trying to be perfectly objective about this," Colonel Cathcart said to Yusurian with the zeal of sudden inspiration. "It's not that I'm being sentimental or anything. I don't give a damn about the men or the airplane. It's just that it looks so lousy on the report. How am I going to cover up something like this in the report?"
"Why don't you give me a medal?" Yusurian suggested timidly.
"For going around twice?"
"You gave one to Hungry Joe when he cracked up that airplane by mistake."
Colonel Cathcart snickered ruefully.
"You'll be lucky if we don't give you a court-martial."
"But I got the bridge the second time around," Yusurian protested. "I thought you wanted the bridge destroyed."
"Oh, I don't know what I wanted,"
Colonel Cathcart cried out in exasperation.
"Look, of course I wanted the bridge destroyed. That bridge has been a source of trouble to me ever since I decided to send you men out to get it. But why couldn't you do it the first time?"
"I didn't have enough time. My navigator wasn't sure we had the right city."
"The right city?"
Colonel Cathcart was baffled.
"Are you trying to blame it all on Arfi now?"
"No, sir. It was my mistake for letting him distract me. All I'm trying to say is that I'm not infallible."
"Nobody's infallible,"
Colonel Cathcart said sharply, and then continued vaguely with an afterthought.
"Nobody is indispensable, either."
There was no rebuttal. Colonel Korn stretched sluggishly.
"We've got to reach a decision,"
he observed casually to Colonel Cathcart.
"We got to reach a decision,"
Colonel Cathcart said to Yusurian.
"And it's all your fault. Why did you have to go around twice? Why couldn't you drop your bombs the first time like all the others?"
"I would have missed the first time." "Seems to me that we're going around twice," Colonel Korn interrupted with a chuckle.
"But what are we going to do?"
Colonel Cathcart exclaimed with distress.
"The others are all waiting outside."
"Why don't we give him a medal?" Colonel Korn proposed.
"For going around twice? What can we give him a medal for?"
"For going around twice,"
Colonel Korn answered with a reflective, self-satisfied smile. "After all, I suppose it did take a lot of courage to go over that target a second time with no other planes around to divert the anti-aircraft fire. And he did hit the bridge, you know, that might be the answer. To act boastfully about something we ought to be ashamed of, that's a trick that never seems to fail."
"You think it will work?"
"Oh, I'm sure it will. And let's promote him to captain, too, just to make certain."
"Don't you think that's gone a bit farther than we have to?"
"No, I don't think so. It's best to play safe, and a captain's not much difference."
"All right," Colonel Cathcart decided. "We'll give him a medal for being brave enough to go around over the target twice, and we'll make him a captain, too."
Colonel Korn reached for his hat. "Exit smiling," he joked, and put his arm around Yusurian's shoulders as they stepped outside the door. 14. Kid Samson. By the time of the mission to Bologna, Yusurian was brave enough not to go around over the target even once. And when he found himself aloft finally in the nose of Kid Samson's plane, he pressed in the button of his throat mic and asked,
Well, what's wrong with the plane?
Kid Sampson let out a shriek.
Is something wrong with the plane? What's the matter?
Kid Sampson's cry turned Yossarian to ice.
Is something the matter?
He yelled in horror.
Are we bailing out? I don't know!
Kid Sampson shot back in anguish, wailing excitedly.
Someone said we're bailing out! Who is this? Anyway, who is this? This is Yossarian in the nose. Yossarian in the nose. I heard you say there was something the matter. Didn't you say there was something the matter? I thought you said there was something wrong. Everything seems okay. Everything is all right.
Yossarian's heart sank. Something was terribly wrong, if everything was all right and they had no excuse for turning back. He hesitated gravely.
I can't hear you, he said. I said everything is all right.
The sun was blinding white on the porcelain blue water below and on the flashing edges of the other airplanes. Yossarian took hold of the colored wires leading to the jackbox of the intercom system and tore them loose.
I still can't hear you, he said.
He heard nothing. Slowly, he collected his map case and his three flak suits and crawled back to the main compartment. Nately, sitting stiffly in the co-pilot seat, spied him through the corner of his eye as he stepped up on the flight deck behind Kid Sampson. He smiled at Yossarian wanly, looking frail and exceptionally young and bashful in the bulky dungeon of his earphones, hat, throat mic, flak suit, and parachute. Yossarian bent close to Kid Sampson's ear.
"I still can't hear you!"
he shouted above the even drone of the engines. Kid Sampson glanced back at him with surprise. Kid Sampson had an angular, comical face with arched eyebrows and a scrawny blonde mustache.
"What?"
he called out over his shoulder.
"I still can't hear you!"
Yossarian repeated.
"You'll have to talk louder!" Kid Sampson said. "I still can't hear you!" "I said... I still can't hear you!"
Yossarian yelled.
"I can't help it!"
Kid Sampson yelled back at him.
"I'm shouting as loud as I can!" "I couldn't hear you over my intercom!"
Yossarian bellowed in mounting helplessness.
"You'll have to turn back!" "For an intercom?"
asked Kid Sampson incredulously.
"Turn back!" said Yossarian. "Before I break your head!"
Kid Sampson looked for moral support toward Nately, who stared away from him pointedly. Yossarian outranked them both. Kid Sampson resisted doubtfully for another moment and then capitulated eagerly with a triumphant whoop.
"That's just fine with me!"
he announced gladly, and blew out a shrill series of whistles up into his mustache.
"Yes, sirree, that's just fine with old Kid Sampson!"
He whistled again and shouted over the intercom.
"Now hear this, my little chickadees. This is Admiral Kid Sampson talking. This is Admiral Kid Sampson squawking, the pride of the Queen's Marines. Yes, sirree, we're turning back, boys. By cracky, we're turning back!"
Nately ripped off his hat and earphones in one jubilant sweep and began rocking back and forth happily like a handsome child in a high chair. Sergeant Knight came plummeting down from the top gun turret and began pounding them all on the back with delirious enthusiasm. Kid Sampson turned the plane away from the formation in a wide, graceful arc and headed toward the airfield. When Yossarian plugged his headset into one of the auxiliary jackboxes, the two gunners in the rear section of the plane were both singing La Cucaracha. Back at the field, the party fizzled out abruptly. An uneasy silence replaced it, and Yossarian was sober and self-conscious as he climbed down from the plane and took his place in the jeep that was already waiting for them. None of the men spoke at all on the drive back through the heavy, mesmerizing quiet, blanketing mountains, seas, and forests. The feeling of desolation persisted when they turned off the road at the squadron. Yossarian got out of the car last. After a minute, Yossarian and a gentle, warm wind were the only things stirring in the haunting tranquility that hung like a drug over the vacated tents. The squadron stood insensate, bereft of everything human, but Doc Danica, who roosted dolorously like a shivering turkey buzzard beside the closed door of the medical tent, his stuffed nose jabbing away in thirsting futility at the hazy sunlight streaming down around him. Yossarian knew Doc Danica would not go swimming with him. Doc Danica would never go swimming again. A person could swoon or suffer a mild coronary occlusion in an inch or two of water and drown to death, be carried out to sea by an undertow, or made vulnerable to poliomyelitis or meningococcus infection through chilling or overexertion. The threat of Bologna to others had instilled in Doc Danica an even more poignant solicitude for his own safety. At night now, he heard burglars. Through the lavender gloom clouding the entrance of the operations tent, Yossarian glimpsed Chief White Half-Oat diligently embezzling whiskey rations, forging the signatures of non-drinkers, and pouring off the alcohol with which he was poisoning himself into separate bottles rapidly in order to steal as much as he could before Captain Black roused himself with recollection and came hurrying over indolently to steal the rest himself. The jeep started up again softly. Kid Samson, Nately, and the others wandered apart in a noiseless eddy of motion and were sucked away into the cloying yellow stillness. The jeep vanished with a cough. Yossarian was alone in a ponderous primeval lull in which everything green looked black, and everything else was imbued with the color of pus. The breeze rustled leaves in a dry and diaphanous distance. He was restless, scared, and sleepy. The sockets of his eyes felt grimy with exhaustion. Wearily, he moved inside the parachute tent with its long table of smooth wood, a nagging bitch of a doubt burrowing painlessly inside a conscience that felt perfectly clear. He left his flak suit and parachute there, and crossed back past the water wagon to the intelligence tent to return his map case to Captain Black, who sat drowsing in his chair with his skinny long legs up on his desk and inquired with indifferent curiosity why Yossarian's plane had turned back. Yossarian ignored him. He set the map down on the counter and walked out. Back in his own tent, he squirmed out of his parachute harness and then out of his clothes. Orr was in Rome, due back that same afternoon from the rest leave he had won by ditching his plane in the waters off Genoa. Nately would already be packing to replace him, entranced to find himself still alive, and undoubtedly impatient to resume his wasted and heartbreaking courtship of his prostitute in Rome. When Yossarian was undressed, he sat down on his cot to rest. He felt much better as soon as he was naked. He never felt comfortable in clothes. In a little while, he put fresh undershorts back on and set out for the beach in his moccasins, a khaki-colored bath towel draped over his shoulders. The path from the squadron led him around a mysterious gun emplacement in the woods. Two of the three enlisted men stationed there lay sleeping on the circle of sandbags, and the third sat eating a purple pomegranate, biting off large mouthfuls between his churning jaws and spewing the ground roughage out away from him into the bushes. When he bit, red juice ran out of his mouth. Yossarian padded ahead into the forest again, caressing his bare, tingling belly adoringly from time to time, as though to reassure himself it was all still there. He rolled a piece of lint out of his navel. Along the ground, suddenly, on both sides of the path, he saw dozens of new mushrooms the rain had spawned, poking their nodular fingers up through the clammy earth like lifeless stalks of flesh, sprouting in such necrotic profusion everywhere he looked that they seemed to be proliferating right before his eyes. There were thousands of them, swarming as far back into the underbrush as he could see, and they appeared to swell in size and multiply in numbers, he spied them. He hurried away from them with a shiver of eerie alarm, and did not slacken his pace until the soil crumbled to dry sand beneath his feet, and they had been left behind. He glanced back apprehensively, half expecting to find the limp white things crawling after him in sightless pursuit, or snaking up through the treetops in a writhing and ungovernable mutative mass. The beach was deserted. The only sounds were hushed ones, the bloated gurgle of the stream, the respirating hum of the tall grass and shrubs behind him, the apathetic moaning of the dumb, translucent waves. The surf was always small, the water clear and cool. Yossarian left his things on the sand and moved through the knee-high waves until he was completely immersed. On the other side of the sea, a bumpy sliver of dark land lay wrapped in mist, almost invisible. He swam languorously out to the raft, held on a moment, and swam languorously back to where he could stand on the sandbar. He submerged himself head first into the green water several times, until he felt clean and wide awake, and then stretched himself out face down in the sand and slept until the planes returning from Bologna were almost overhead, and the great cumulative rumble of their many engines came crashing in through his slumber in an earth-shattering roar. He woke up blinking with a slight pain in his head and opened his eyes upon a world boiling in chaos in which everything was in proper order. He gasped in utter amazement at the fantastic sight of the 12 flights of planes organized calmly into exact formation. The scene was too unexpected to be true. There were no planes spurting ahead with wounded, none lagging behind with damage. No distress flares smoked in the sky. No ship was missing but his own. For an instant he was paralyzed with a sensation of madness. Then he understood, and almost wept at the irony. The explanation was simple. Clouds had covered the target before the planes could bomb it, and the mission to Bologna was still to be flown. He was wrong. There had been no clouds. Bologna had been bombed. Bologna was a milk run. There had been no flak there at all. 15. Pilchard and Wren. Captain Pilchard and Captain Wren, the inoffensive joint squadron operations officers, were both mild, soft-spoken men of less than middle height who enjoyed flying combat missions and begged nothing more of life and Colonel Cathcart than the opportunity to continue flying them. They had flown hundreds of combat missions and wanted to fly hundreds more. They assigned themselves to every one. Nothing so wonderful as war had ever happened to them before, and they were afraid it might never happen to them again. They conducted their duties humbly and reticently, with a minimum of fuss, and went to great lengths not to antagonize anyone. They smiled quickly at everyone they passed. When they spoke, they mumbled. They were shifty, cheerful, subservient men who were comfortable only with each other, and never met anyone else's eye, not even Yossarian's eye, at the open-air meeting they called to reprimand him publicly for making Kid Samson turn back from the mission to Bologna.
"Those,"
said Captain Pilchard, who had thinning dark hair and smiled awkwardly,
"when you turn back from a mission, try to make sure it's for something important, will you? Not for something unimportant, like a defective intercom or something like that. Okay?"
Captain Wren has more he wants to say to you on that subject.
"Captain Pilcher's right, fellas," said Captain Wren. "And that's all I'm going to say to you on that subject. Well, we finally got to Bologna today, and we found out it's a milk run. We were all a little nervous, I guess, and didn't do too much damage. Well, listen to this. Colonel Cathcart got permission for us to go back, and tomorrow we're really going to paste those ammunition dumps. Now, what do you think about that?"
And to prove to Yossarian that they bore him no animosity, they even assigned him to fly lead bombardier with McWatt in the first formation when they went back to Bologna the next day. He came in on the target like a Havermeyer, confidently taking no evasive action at all. and suddenly they were shooting the living shit out of him. Heavy flak was everywhere. He had been lulled, lured, and trapped, and there was nothing he could do but sit there like an idiot and watch the ugly black puffs smashing up to kill him. There was nothing he could do until his bombs dropped, but look back into the bomb sight where the fine crosshairs in the lens were glued magnetically over the target exactly where he had placed them, intersecting perfectly deep inside the yard of his block of camouflaged warehouses before the base of the first building. He was trembling steadily as the plane crept ahead. He could hear the hollow boom, 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 boom of the flak pounding all around him in overlapping measures of four, the sharp, piercing crack of a single shell exploding suddenly very close by. His head was busting with a thousand dissonant impulses as he prayed for the bombs to drop. He wanted to sob. The engines droned on monotonously like a fat, lazy fly. At last the indices on the bomb site crossed, tripping away the 8 500-pounders, one after the other. The plane lurched upward buoyantly with the lightened load. Yossarian bent away from the bomb site crookedly to watch the indicator on his left. When the pointer touched zero, he closed the bomb bay doors and over the intercom at the very top of his voice shrieked, "Turn right, hard!" McQuatt responded instantly. With a grinding howl of engines, he flipped the plane over on one wing and wrung it around remorselessly in a screaming turn away from the twin spires of flak Yossarian had spied stabbing toward them. Then Yossarian had McQuatt climb and keep climbing higher and higher until they tore free, finally, into a calm, diamond-blue sky that was sunny and pure everywhere and laced in the distance with long, white veils of tenuous fluff. The wind strummed soothingly against the cylindrical panes of his windows, and he relaxed exultantly, only until they picked up speed again and then turned McQuatt left and plunged him right back down, noticing with a transitory spasm of elation the mushrooming clusters of flak leaping open high above him and back over his shoulder to the right, exactly where he could have been if he had not turned left and dived. He leveled McQuatt out with another harsh cry and whipped him upward and around again into a ragged blue patch of unpolluted air, just as the bombs he had dropped began to strike. The first one fell in the yard, exactly where he had aimed. And then the rest of the bombs from his own plane and from the other planes in his flight burst open on the ground in a charge of rapid orange flashes across the tops of the buildings, which collapsed instantly in a vast, churning wave of pink and gray and coal-black smoke that went rolling out turbulently in all directions and quaked convulsively in its bowels, as though from great blasts of red and white and golden sheet lightning.
"Well, will you look at that?"
Arfi marveled sonorously right beside Yossarian, his plump orbicular face sparkling with a look of bright enchantment.
"There must have been an ammunition dump down there."
Yossarian had forgotten about Arfi.
"Get out!" he shouted at him. "Get out of the nose!"
Arfi smiled politely and pointed down toward the target and a generous invitation for Yossarian to look. Yossarian began slapping at him insistently and signaled wildly toward the entrance of the crawlway.
"Get back in the ship!" he cried frantically. "Get back in the ship!"
Arfi shrugged amiably.
"I can't hear you," he explained.
Yossarian seized him by the straps of his parachute harness and pushed him backward toward the crawlway, just as the plane was hit with a jarring concussion that rattled his bones and made his heart stop. He knew at once they were all dead.
"Climb!"
he screamed into the intercom at McQuatt when he saw he was still alive. "Climb, you bastard! Climb! 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 Climb!" The plane zoomed upward again in a climb that was swift and straining, until he leveled it out with another harsh shout at McWatt and wrenched it around once more in a roaring, merciless 45-degree turn that sucked his insides out in one enervating sniff and left him floating fleshless in midair, until he leveled McWatt out again just long enough to hurl him